another episode of Everything is Canon, the Centrelings podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the easiest is to email me at steve@centrelings.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at SteveDunk5 or at Everything Canon. Today in the show, I'm talking to Corey Anderson all about her fantastic debut, What Beauty There Is, which is described as an exhilarating, emotionally powerful, and superbly written thriller that's Winter's Bone meets The Road. It's definitely all those things and a whole lot more, as its stark and haunting prose creates an atmosphere you won't soon forget. By injecting a lot of her own truth into the story, Corey's debut is a powerful tale about brutality, beauty, and people mostly just trying to survive. We talk about the thrill of her debut, the sometimes difficult and personal road it took to get here, the fact that there isn't a sequel and why that's okay, and much, much more. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now, but definitely double back after you've read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. If you're a frequent listener, then you know around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices, and this should go all year long. I'd also like to mention a new nonprofit organization that was announced today, Diverse Voices, Inc., whose mission is to, quote, empower and advocate for minority, underrepresented, and other marginalized groups of writers, illustrators, and other book creators. This is the brainchild of literary agent Beth Villon, who is the founder of DVCon as well. You might know that. Please go to diversevoicesinc.org to find out more and how you can help in any way. And finally, I want to say, send my thoughts are going to go out to the people who lost a friend or family member in Colorado. I know I'm usually the minority on this issue, but I want all guns on the earth just fucking gone, all of them. It's driving me crazy. But okay, now that that's out of the way, Corey Anderson was born in Idaho and grew up an outdoor girl in the rugged Middle Rockies. From an early age, she loved books, and it was around the time she discovered the classic Jack London novel White Fang, something you might want to take note of if you're going to read this book. She's the winner of the League of the Utah Writers Young Adult Novel Award and grand prize in the Storymakers Conference First Chapter Contest. She now lives in the Wasatch Mountains, where she spends countless hours writing, sometimes in the woods with just a pencil and paper. Nice, old school. She's here today to discuss her debut novel, What Beauty There Is, which is described as an exhilarating, emotionally powerful, and superbly written thriller that's Winter's Bone meets The Road. It's definitely all those things and a whole lot more. I believe I said something along the lines of good fucking luck putting this book down. Please welcome to the show, Corey Anderson. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good, thank you. Sorry for the long intro, but lots going on in the world.
I appreciate taking a minute to send my thoughts and love to those who were involved in the shooting in Colorado and those who've lost their lives and their families.
It's such a crazy issue. And I am, it's true. I am like one of these, I'm a way far left progressive dude. And I want all guns gone. I'm tired of it. I don't care. Sorry, hunters. Sorry. You know, all these other people, you know, the responsible people, I'm sorry, but I don't know. I need them all gone. It's driving me crazy. But
my viewpoint is much the same.
Okay, so. Perfect. Yeah. It's hard. And I understand in this, I'm in Canada. So it's the issue. We do have similar, but not quite. And I understand in the States, it's so different, even from state to state, right? Region to region. And I know it goes back such a long way. And it's a touchy subject in the US, isn't it? And so, yeah, like even where, you know, Idaho, and that's, you know, like there's, you probably grew up, you were raised in the outdoors a little bit, weren't you? So
I was.
And this is not to paint you as a bad person at all, I swear, but I believe you were probably, if you did have guns, responsible, your parent and your father as well. We'll talk. I want to mention him actually in a second, but do you have any gun handling experience or?
I do. My dad was law enforcement for Targhee Caribou National Forest, which is where the final scenes of the book take place.
Right, right.
And so he carried a gun. He didn't ever use a gun during his entire years, in law enforcement there on national forest land.
Never had to fire it once, eh? That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I was around guns growing up and had a respect for them that he ingrained in us.
Amazing.
So.
That's great. And, you know, it's like, I wish that was the entirety of the issue, but, and when we say guns and, you know, obviously we talk these friggin' AR-15s and stuff is just, it's nuts to me.
Yeah, that's just a whole different thing, isn't it?
Military, like, it's trying to be crazy.
And availability to them. There's so many big questions.
And that's the frustrating part, I think, isn't it, too, with especially when it gets down to like the legislative part of it. It's like, how could you not agree with making it harder to get them, right? It's one thing if you want to keep them and you know, ride or die Second Amendment, but how could you not be okay with just making it a little harder? Anyway, whatever. That's not where we're here. I don't want to talk about that. But anyways, you can't help it. Life, it's life, right? So
I agree.
As always, too, during these times, you know, unfortunately, the past year, our baseline is a pandemic. So I just want to say, I hope you and your family are safe and healthy during the pandemic. And
thanks so much. We are.
Good. Yeah. It's, we don't, you know, again, in Canada, we don't have nearly the numbers that you have in the States. And it's a scary thing. And this is the scary time, too, for me a little bit, because it's that transition time. Right.
I agree. People are starting to, you know, relax their guard a little bit.
Yeah. Because things are getting better, right? Technically. But, you know, when vaccines are rolling out, maybe not as quickly as we'd like. But so this is going to be the sensitive time for sure. So it's everybody just hang on a little bit longer and we'll be all right.
Yes. Stay safe a little bit longer. Keep up the mask wearing.
That's it, right? Like,
get the vaccine. I don't need to tell people what to do, but, you know, use those. The recommendations that we're being given about how to be safe.
So. You know what? Fuck it. I'll tell people what to do. Some people need to be told what to do. Wear your goddamn masks, and it's such an easy thing. I want to put a pin in this because I really want to, you know, talk about you in the book. But what I'm looking forward to seeing is, or interested in seeing is, I think there's going to be mask for life people now. Interesting to see, you know, what sticks around, because I think we can all agree some things that came about because of the pandemic are good, like people wash their hands a lot more now and you know, things like this. And it'll be interesting to see what sticks and what sort of drops off. But
it will be interesting. I think there will definitely be more masks as a way of life.
Yeah. I've asked this a lot too from authors the last 12 months. I'm also interested to see what stories come from the past 12 months. Will it be hopeful, cynical, dire? Some authors have just said they haven't even felt like being creative during the 12 months.
Yeah.
What's it been like for you as a creative person?
It has been tough.
Yeah.
It really has. I think that for me, creativity comes when I'm feeling kind of calm and secure. And
okay.
So that has been a big change to have just so much upheaval in the world. And so I have slowed down dramatically. I'm definitely behind from where I had hoped to be in drafting my second book.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that picks up now that we're kind of coming out of things.
Right. Well, you have a deadline, I assume. So yeah, you better.
I do. I do have a deadline that I am not meeting right now.
Oh, no. All right. Well, I'm sure your team will be patient enough, I'm sure. But I guess let's just talk about, right, since you brought it up, let's talk about that right now. So I'm such an idiot. I didn't even realize this was going to be more than one book. I just didn't bother to look that information up when I started reading the book.
It's wrong on Goodreads and whatnot.
Okay.
No, I have a second book coming out that's a complete different world. They're both standalone books.
Okay.
So yeah, this world has seen its conclusion.
Oh, okay.
As far as storytelling goes.
Well, that's kind of big news then. Yeah. Because like, you know,
yeah.
I didn't know. Cause well, the thing is it works both ways. And, but when I did get to the end, again, still not knowing it was, or I had thought it was a series or had been misled yet. I get to the end, I'm like, what the fuck? And I was just like, I'm like, this can't,
yeah.
Because of the way it ends, right? And right. which we won't talk about. But and then, you know, just you're looking, you know, you're just digging around, looking some stuff up, and then yeah, Goodreads is, as we know right now, isn't correct, but it said another book was coming. I'm like, oh, okay. Good.
Yeah, I totally need to fix that. But yeah. I know that the ending makes most people have the same response as you.
Yeah. You know, and that's
definitely kind of a literary ending.
No, for sure. And you know what? And now that I know that, even just right now thinking about it, it's like, you know, of course I would love to see more, but it is, like I said a second ago, it does work really well both ways. So, you know, just thinking about it now, I'm like, that's a really nice spot too. Oh, you got a pupper there. Mine are upstairs. I'm sure you're gonna. No, you're gonna hear.
The mailman is here.
That's okay. You'll hear mine at some point, probably as well. I locked them upstairs though, so that if we do hear them, hopefully they're not too loud. But what kind of dog you have? Who's barking?
Oh, he is a golden doodle.
A golden doodle.
His name is. Yes, his name is Cooper.
Cooper, so, right on. Cooper, yeah. Sounds like a nice boy.
Cooper is a guard dog when people come to the door.
So. That's what they're supposed to do. I don't mind bark too. Like people are like, don't you hate that? I'm like, no, they're supposed to bark. That's their job. I don't have a problem with that. I'd be worried if they didn't bark when someone came to the door. I'd be like, right. Anyways, yeah. But now that just mentioning it now and thinking about the ending it does work really well. And one of the things that did bother me about having to have a second go at it when I still thought that was, and this is going to be hard to talk about with, you know, cause we're having a non-spoiler discussion, but there's somebody who isn't around anymore. And, and that would have been a tough, emotionally tough, you know, thing to take if they're, you know, thinking there was more story to come. And I had prepared myself for that.
Right.
Emotionally. I was like, well, there's another book coming. I guess I got to get over it. All right. So that's good to know. And you got to get that fixed. Hopefully that doesn't bum people.
I will get on that.
But finally, the book does work well both ways. So it shouldn't discourage people too much. So debut book, this thing is getting very good reviews. I don't know if you read reviews or not. I typically, you know what? I just thought of something actually I wanted to do the other day. I'm like, I want to be a Goodreads reviewer because.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
Because I love that. There's so many, I'll read them only after I've written mine or after I've, you know what I mean? Like made my decisions. I won't, because obviously you don't want it to influence you in any way or whatever. And you know, I'll read them and I'll be reading these reviews sometimes. And I'm like, this person's an idiot. not because I agree, because they didn't agree with me, whether I liked a book or not, but just like, I just feel like some people just don't get certain things sometimes, especially from a storytelling perspective, because there is a science behind writing a story. You know what I mean? Like there's structure.
Oh, definitely.
Right. There's mechanics, there's structure, there's certain, you know, so, and some people just don't seem to get that. So it's frustrating for me sometimes. So have you done that yet? Cause I mean, I would recommend not only.
Well,
because, yeah,
I have read trade reviews. And okay. So, you know, like the trade reviews, I think it's important for me to know what's going on.
True enough. Yep.
But Goodreads feels like a war zone for me.
Yeah, so I agree. It feels like that totally, for me, and I don't even write. Yeah.
I stay away from Goodreads because I have a tender heart. And so when I read something, I read a couple of reviews early on. Mm-hmm. I was getting some great reviews, but then I read one that just was pretty scathing. Mm-hmm. And it just... oh, it got me. I mean, there were a few weeks that I was thinking about this review. And I think, I will tell you the words that will never leave me, that it said that this reviewer thought that my book was very 2012 torture porn.
Oh my God. Okay.
Like, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that'll be, I don't even know what to say to that. I'd like to meet this person.
Either.
They have an interesting idea of what, it's like, I remember 2012 and I think I know what torture porn is. So it's like, I'm just wondering, maybe I've been wrong this whole time about torture porn.
And I think it was probably someone who was, you know, unhappy with the, there is violence in the book, you know, I don't spare the brutality.
It's a dark book.
You know, what's happening. Yeah. So I'm sure that's what she was referring to, but maybe, you know, there were a couple weeks that I was like, oh, I write I write 2012 torture porn.
Nice.
So great.
Well, you know, this is something
that's the worst. And then I just stopped. I stopped reading, you know, all of the
funny thing is, though, the funny thing is, you, like, in somebody else's hands, that's a compliment to some group somewhere. Someone's like, that's going to make somebody want to read the book somewhere, right? They're like, I love 2000, right? They're like, I love 2012 and I love torture porn. I'm going
to
read this book.
I decided to embrace it.
Yeah.
Like, okay,
oh, yeah. No, no.
I'm going to get, you know, some person who's going to respond like this, and that's okay.
Yeah, Goodreads, so, isn't, Goodreads isn't for authors. Like, I wouldn't recommend authors reading Goodreads for sure, because it's just, it's kind of a weird hellscape in a lot of ways. But trade reviews, yeah, for sure. Like, it's like you want to know what the viewing, the reading viewership, like the public is, what the general idea, the feeling is, for sure. Of course, I think that's important. But yeah, if once you get into like the nitty gritty, it can get, unless you just sort by 5-star reviews and just, you know,
right,
you know, and just you could just do that, I guess. Yeah, but anyways, but but since we're on the topic anyways, but like this book though, it is, you know, this idea of finding good in dark places is usually like a theistic realm or like a new age self-help concept, but you know, this book is very much about squeezing sort of every last drop of light, you know, sort of out of the shadows. I wrote down, it's sort of very close to being a, it dances on the edge of miserable, but doesn't quite jump across, you know, and it doesn't quite jump across. It kind of feels like an R-rated Peter Pan or something to me in a lot of ways.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and then this is, that's not a slight. Again, I'm a Life is Too Short person, so I don't BS people typically. Like, I like this book a lot. I think you know that. So, so anything I say is not meant as a negative necessarily, but it is dark. And we're going to talk about kind of why it's dark, and it's important. It's an important conversation I want to have with you, actually, but just sort of in a process, you know, frame of mind, where was the line for you? Were you conscious of that? Like did you say, this is starting to feel like torture porn, I better dial it back a little bit?
Yeah. You know, I was conscious of it. I think that the thing that I felt was really important was balancing the dark, which I felt was important to tell the story with truth.
Yeah.
I really wanted to balance that kind of brutality with tenderness and with, you know, relationships that felt real and caring. And I wanted to balance it with a sense of love and hope.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether I've done that or not, we'll see. You know, that's left for readers to decide. But I do think there's a lot of darkness in the story. I'm drawn to dark stories. Mm-hmm. I love thrillers. I love horror. And I was writing the book at a time when there were things in my life that were dark. And I was like coming to terms with them and trying to make sense of them. And so for me, writing was really a metaphor for this process of making sense of survival in hard times.
Well, that's what I want to talk to you a little bit about, because, you know, reading your bio, it's clear there's so much of you in this book. And I think you're courageous enough to be open about some of the bad shit some of the bad shit that's happened to you, or just can happen to anyone. Right. But, you know, since we're talking to you, let's talk about you. And at the same time, because like you, there's a lot of you in this book, you know, I realize once you've read the book and read your bio, you're like, oh my God. And it's, so it's an easy way to sort of talk about both the book and you. So, and since it's in your bio, I assume it's fair game. If it's not and crossing a line into maybe too personal, just tell me to shut up and we'll move on. That's no problem at all. But, yeah, like you mentioned your father already, like Park Ranger, there's a character in this book, Doyle, could have been your father. It dawns on me, right? Doyle's a great guy. I mean, he's, you know, there's a lot of characters in this book. You know, there's a guy named Bardem in it who's not a nice guy. And you have Doyle, who is a nice guy. And even though maybe sort of like, you know, Ava and Jack and Maddie are sort of the stars of the book, the leads anyways, this book is really about Bardem versus Doyle.
It is.
That's the good, evil, light, dark, for right? I mean, in a lot of ways. So, you know, just, you mentioned your father. And again, he's taught you all these different great things of how to survive in the forest and in the winter. And I mean, this, like, reading your bio was almost like an expanded summary of the book, right? In a lot of ways. So is that, clearly there's intent there, right?
There was intent when I started writing the book. So much of Jack and Ava are me. Their hopes, well, the Ava and stuff, and
yeah,
fears.
I mean, if you want to talk about the Ava stuff, we will, but that's gets into some dark places, but it's totally up to you. But yeah, we'll just sort of stick with, like, we'll just start sort of with Dad and Doyle and the woods and stuff for now, because your writing is fantastic. The way you describe, the way you set a scene is very cinematic, and it's like you feel the cold and you feel the wind and the bitterness and everything. And Doyle and all your characters are so tactile and well-defined, and Doyle is in particular. So yeah, is that, sorry, I kind of interrupted your thought process there, but the inspiration is clear and present.
Well, I really appreciate your wonderful compliment of, you know, describing the scenes as cinematic, because that was something that I love in good storytelling and something that I aspired to. Mm-hmm. In fact, when writing scenes, I often would see them kind of as movie scenes, and dialogue and things like that were very, you know, I am just a huge movie lover. And so those things were very much, I was instructed by movie scenes, and I love Nordic noir and crime noir. Movies like that definitely inspired me in the way that I chose to write characters, dialogue, setting, all of those things. And as for Doyle, I really patterned Doyle after my dad.
Yeah.
My dad is Doyle.
Well, then I love your dad, because how can you not love Doyle? Doyle's a great, but and the thing is like, again, this, it goes to the theme of the whole book too. It's like, you know, Doyle's a good, at the end of the day, a good guy, but, you know, not uncomplicated.
Right. Yeah. And I wanted him to not be kind of a cardboard character that was just there to, you know, support the rest of the story. I really wanted him to be able to be an adult character in a young adult book that was three-dimensional and that had his own hopes and goals and his own history that he was haunted by. And so, you know, we cut a little bit of Doyle in order to kind of blend in editing phase in order to kind of blend things out. But I feel like we did a good job of keeping him intact enough that the reader could grow to love him. I hope so, at least.
Yeah, he's sort of like, again, it just that, you know, is just that sort of great cinematic sheriff guy, like No Country for Old Men, you know, like just on the trail. And he's tough, but tender, I guess we'll say. He's one of the things too, you know, you mentioned in your bio again, and it's in your book a lot, and really just sort of kicks the book off too. The similarities end, I obviously, at some point when it comes to being a good mother, but Jack and Maddie's mom, it has a tough go. And, you know, this book starts out and Jack and Maddie are immediately thrust into they've already been in a bad-ish situation, but it gets a lot worse real quickly.
You
found yourself sort of, you know, in a situation where you were on your own and had some kids to take care of.
Right.
Was there any part of this part of the story that was painful, therapeutic? You know, how have you come to terms with that? Like, how was that, writing that? Because that's, you know, again, talk about some personal shit. You know, like you know, people won't know what I'm talking about with the mother as far as how bad it does get with her, but, you know, I assume you didn't get that bad.
Yeah, opening scene is pretty rough.
It's pretty rough. So, but you've experienced some of what, you know, she has and the kids, you know, and having those kids especially.
Yeah. So I think, I don't know how many years ago it was. It's probably been about 10 years ago now.
Right.
I had just finished writing a fantasy book, which I had put my whole heart and soul into. And I had shopped it. And although it came very close to securing an agent, it ultimately fell through. And at about the exact same time, so I was coming to terms with not being sure whether I was really, truly ever going to be a writer, which was just such a huge dream. And at about the same time as I, you know, kind of was grappling with that, I also separated from my husband and was beginning to go through the process of getting divorced. And I suddenly found myself within a couple of months having an eviction notice and a pantry that was growing increasingly bare by the day. And I had a son and a daughter who were young and who I felt responsible for taking care of. And I suddenly just found myself feeling really desperate and wondering if I had the ability to tackle life. Like I had to figure out how to put food on the table and how to work full time and how to take care of two kids. And it felt really overwhelming and I was scared. And it was during that time that I wrote the first scene of What Beauty There Is. Mm. And so I think that, you know, that first scene is shocking. Yep. And it was very much me putting to pen on the paper how I was feeling. Mm. I was grieving. Mm-hmm. And I was desperate.
It's powerful. It's really emotional. And I mean, now knowing, you know, how, you know, close it was to your experience, you know, makes it even more so. And I got to say, like I said earlier too, I think it's really courageous to put yourself out there like this. And I had a really great conversation with another author recently who, you know, there's always this fine line, you know, how much an author is willing to put themselves into the story or a character. And a lot of times they get called out on it by a shitty, you know, person online, you know, because they don't know any better. Like, who are you to talk about this issue or that issue? You don't know anything. And they're like, actually, I do know a little something about it because I experienced it. But at the same, but it's just like, there's this weird arrogance now where, because of things like social media, you know, it's like, I'm entitled to know everything about you. And if you don't tell me enough, or you tell me something that I don't believe you, you're a phony. And it's such a weird time to be an author, but it has to do with more of how much you interact, I think, on social media than anything else. But, you know, knowing how personal this story is to you now, for sure, really makes me, it's hard. Cause now it's like, I feel like I know you a little bit more now personally. And
it's pretty revealing.
It is very revealing. And you know, I don't even know. I don't even have a question. It's just like, I really just want to fucking give you a hug.
Well, I'm good.
No, I know you're good. Yeah. I'm joking, obviously. It is very revealing. And it adds weight. It just adds so much weight to this story. And not that it even needed it necessarily, because it is, again, it's written so well, you can't help but feel it already. But, you know, like I said, I was reading your bio. I'm like, good God, this is the book. this is her life. This might as well be an autobiography. Like,
in a way, there are parts that feel like they just really did come straight from me. And I remember when I started writing, it was almost an act of rebellion, I think.
Right.
I had written for a decade and I'd written lots of stories, and I'd watched other writing friends kind of get on the path to success. And I wondered, well, what am I doing that mm-hmm. isn't enough? What am I doing? And it was at that time when I was feeling like life was very torn apart that mm-hmm. I felt like, well, if you're going to give this your last Hail Mary and you're going to write something, what can you write that will really be you? And what can you write that will tell the truth as honestly as you can? And so I was thinking about that when I started writing. I thought, I don't think I've written something yet that really has the core of me in it. Mm. And that really tells, you know, they say in writing, show, don't tell? And have I written a story yet that really shows me? And I thought, well, I can't do that, you know, and show me. What I need to do is take those emotions and that empathy and those things that we read story for, that humanity. And then I need to make up a story that tells the truth about that.
But one of the other really, this might be maybe where the people get the torture porn thing from. But there's a character, Ava, who suffers some trauma for sure. And it not, you know, and you don't, it's not explicit in any way whatsoever. So I don't know why people would use those words to describe it. It's implied more than anything else, which thank you for that, because I think some people, it can get exploitative, right? In a lot of stories.
Right.
And it's used incorrectly a lot of the time. And I think restraint is a much more powerful tool. And I also think it's a much more skilled tool as well. So kudos to that. Ava suffers some trauma, and you admit to suffering some similar trauma in your own life. And again, maybe same question with regards to the mother character. Tough to write, cathartic. I mean, it was a long time ago, so you know, I hope you found peace with it. Were those scenes difficult to, again, like as you said, put pen to paper?
I think that strangely, those scenes were not the toughest to write. I think that I felt those scenes deeply and wanted to describe them well, but it did feel cathartic. It felt like that it was something that I was making sense of when I wrote about it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Ava's story is definitely a metaphor for my assault. I was about Ava's age when I was assaulted. Mm-hmm. And it tore me apart. It tore my world apart. And for a very long time, I thought that I had developed this black heart. I really believed that I'd lost the capacity to love.
You say and that so in your bio, yeah.
Yeah, you yeah. see that in Ava's storyline. And really that's part of her arc in the story coming to terms with this black heart that she feels that she has. And I did think that I wanted to treat it with subtlety. I didn't want the story to be about that. But, what is the story about is such a big question, right? Because there are different layers to what the story is about. But what Ava, the path that Ava travels and the journey that she goes on with Fardem, her father, is definitely, for me, probably, if I were to pick one storyline that's most dear to my heart, that's it.
Mm. It's an interesting sort of fantasy fulfilled situation with you now knowing more about you and the book and you know how closely the two are related, right? And you know that father-daughter relationship and thinking about you having to write, you know, these characters, that relationship in particular, and have Doyle to juxtapose it, right? Where's Freud? There's some stuff there, but I want to move away from this because it's not, you know what? It's not anyone's fucking business and it's not even my business, because it's in the bio and because, you know, I think it's a good question and I think it's a good area to examine because you talk about it openly and once people read the book, it's clear the connection. Let's just end with this. You wrote something in your bio that I think would make a great tagline for this book and just a lot of stories in general. Just as hard things can hurt us, but it doesn't mean we're broken. And that's a beautiful way to put it, I think. And that line is actually in reference to you, but I think that could work for this book just as well.
That's great. I love that.
One thing, if I could just say
one thing before we move on.
Yeah.
I think that... something that I did not think of when writing the book that I now want to really make sure, you know, that I dispel any belief that Bardem is based on my dad at all. Because Bardem
we already said he's Doyle. We already said he's Doyle, right?
Yeah.
That's why I said it's interesting when you look at the father-daughter relationship and like I said, juxtaposed with Doyle on the scene too, and you have that's why I said at the beginning of the show, it's Barnum versus Doyle, right? And
it is.
I mean, there's, like I said, I'm not a psychologist. I'm just saying there's some stuff in your head going on that came out in this book, and it's compelling, it's personal, it's strong. And I mean, you've got these two characters and their archetypes and all that stuff for sure, but clearly they have places in your life too, right? And but I said it before, but sure, let's say it again. Doyle is your dad. Doyle is Corey's dad, not Bardem.
Doyle is my dad.
All right. Let's talk. Okay. Book time. The actual book. I'm going to read the summary, but then we'll talk about sort of what's like the beating heart of the book, because I hate long summaries, and this one isn't long, so I get to read it, so that's fun. To understand the truth, you have to start at the beginning. Winter in Idaho. The sky is dark. It is cold enough to crack bones. Jack Morton has nothing left except his younger brother, Maddie, who he'd do anything for, even die for. Now, with their mother gone and their funds quickly dwindling, Jack needs to make a choice: lose his brother to foster care or find the drug money that sent his father to prison. He chooses the money. Ava Bardem lives in isolation, a life of silence. For 17 years, her father, a merciless man, has controlled her fate. He has taught her to love no one. Now Victor Bardem is stalking the same money as Jack. When he picks up on Jack's trail, Ava must make her own wrenching choice: remain silent or speak and help the brothers survive. Choices, they do in fact come at a price. That's the promotional language of the book. Obviously, just barely scratches the surface. So what's the beating, you know, I'm not going to ask you like, you know, what do you want people to take away from this book? What's the answer is probably in what we've been discussing the last 30 minutes, just buried deep in there somewhere for sure. Probably not even deep, but what's the beating heart of this book in your mind?
Oh, that's so hard. I think that it kind of, everything really does center around this question of, you know, if you had one shot to save everything that mattered to you, what would you do?
Right.
And what lengths would you go to save what's important to you? And I think that there's something really, really vital and crucial to that question. And just going down that road and asking it of yourself, I think that it helps us to understand one another. And I hope that the reader, you know, has empathy for Jack and Ava and can see why they choose the things that they do, and, you know, goes on the journey with them. And I don't know, I think it's just, I feel like life right now in our society, with all of the ills that we are facing, that so many of us feel like we are surviving. And so that survival story for me just runs really deep.
Sure.
What lengths would you go to do what you need to survive?
Yeah, everyone is just barely surviving in this book. Like, no one has it good in this book, right? Let's keep that out there too, right? There's no like happy people in this book, right? They certainly have moments of you know, they manufacture happiness, but out of the ashes of something awful, right? Like it's a really interesting book that way, because, you know, depending on whether you're an optimist or, you know, or cynical or whatever, it's you know, I think this book in many ways is sort of like a Rorschach, you know, painting, you know what I mean? It's interesting to see what other people see in the story.
Yeah, I think so. And I, you know, I do think that it's very different for young adult. I don't think that it's a real typical young adult book, but I also, you know, it was my aim to do something different. I was so deeply changed by books like The Road and Winter's Bone.
Right.
And those books are dark books, but, you know, through reading them, I think that there's something really beautiful that comes from going on that journey.
This was something I had a discussion with recently. I think it was a middle grade author, and we were talking, you know, because usually these books are, the genre they're in is you know, dictated by the age of the lead character typically, right? So that's why this would be a YA book, I guess. But, you know, I'd like to see, it doesn't mean it has to be YA content though, right? I mean, I'd like to see, like, this book could be bumped up to adult, I think, for sure.
Right.
Easily. And it would, and I don't think anybody would even question it. I don't think, I doubt there'd be anybody be like, no, this is more of a YA book. Well, you know, like, it's, right. And if they said that, it's only because we have this rule where, you know, if the lead character is a teen, then it's a YA, you know, whatever. But, you know, I think this book, to your point, would work, you know, teenagers, adults, I think anyone's going to read this book. And they're going to see something different reflect back at them, probably. But at the same time, I think this will appeal to a lot of different age groups. One of the things I liked about this book was we talked about, you know, this thing sort of kicks off in a dramatic way. And one of the things I liked about your writing style in particular was, you know, I felt invested. I felt compelled from the very beginning.
Oh, good.
Yeah, like I.
That makes me happy.
Yeah, well, I just said something like I couldn't. There's no way I could put this book down once I started. I don't know how anybody could, depending on, you know, people's lives are busy. They can't. I'm a loser. I have nothing else to do. I have no kids. I have the time to sit and read a book from start to finish. But yeah, I really think people are gonna struggle to put this book down once they get started. And whether they like the book at the end of the day or not, who cares? I mean, like, you know, as long as they buy it. What was it about your, you know, the process of writing this book? Because you do some interesting things too, like with the first person, you know, epigraphs and there was a lot of interesting things, choices you made in this book. And like, where does this, because it's an interesting style you have and it's not typical. And I'm wondering, you know, this just sort of came naturally to you, I guess, did it? Or, you know, how many drafts did you do of this book?
I wrote really slowly. I was working full time and, you know, raising kids. And so I did not write quickly. And right. Often what would happen is I would find some little strand of thought or, you know, kind of like a strand of even poetry that would be meaningful to me. And I would jot it down somewhere and then scenes would kind of grow out from those things really organically. And when I wrote things down, then I did not outline it. It would just kind of come one little plot piece at a time. And
most authors don't outline their first books. It's a weird thing I've noticed. it's only when they're sophomore and when they move on from there as they start outlining, and they actually come to appreciate it actually too. But it's something I've noticed. I'm going to ask more authors
really
that, because it's something that I, yeah, it is interesting. I'm going to ask more about that, but sorry.
But I wrote it slowly. And right. Then I think I went through one revision and then sent it out.
Okay.
So I didn't pore over it multiple times. It kind of came out as it was. And Ava's first person narrative. So there's this narrative right. framework, you know, right. that is Ava's thoughts and she's talking directly to the reader.
Right.
That kind of came from The Book Thief. I don't know if you're familiar with The Book Thief, but yep. in that book, Death is the narrator.
Right.
And I really wanted to be able to have a narrative framework in which the narrator was not limited by point of view, but that she could show the story kind of from this omniscient viewpoint.
Right.
And I thought, well, how can she do that? And so I'm not going to go further than that. But
Right. And that's a tricky premise too, though, because like that can get away from you a lot of times as a writer, right? And
it can. And
when it does get away from you, it really creates confusion for the reader a lot of times too. But I thought you did a great job far as that goes. Yeah, I always, one of the good things too, like I always, you know, a lot of my favorite, you know, all time writers, one of the things I find that they're all good at is, you know, their pacing and plotting is good. And I always know where their characters are in the story at all times. And I got a good sense from that, from this book for sure. One of the things I liked about this book, the characters in particular, from top to bottom, is they're all very capable and perceptible. You know what I mean? Like they're not indestructible for sure. Some of them for sure aren't.
Right.
Yeah. But they're all very, you know, they're very capable and they're very perceptible. And I can't help but think, again, that sort of a little bit of you rubbed off in that sense, because you did say, you know, like you grew up, you know, dad taught you how to do all sorts of things in the woods in the winter, how to survive the winters and that. And it is a harsh world. It's a harsh landscape that you create in this story. And all the characters do. Was that ever, you know, it's like, it's like I need, what was your thinking with the, just the characters in general? Like, I need to, because you need to create sympathy, but you don't want them to be, you know, you can't also fall into a hubris trap at the same time, right? Like, you can't have a situation where, you know, I'm questioning, you know, every action they take. And I'm like, well, of course he knows how to do that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that's just running through my mind is just where I come from. Yeah. This part of Idaho where I come from is so integral to the story, and mm-hmm. just kind of the people there and the culture. It's really the bedrock of the story. And I do come from this place where you do what needs doing. Mm. And so, you know, Jack says that in the story, you will do what needs doing. Right. And, you know, you get the job done, and you have like this grit about making sure that you just tackle things. Mm-hmm. I think that's there in the story with the characters.
Yeah.
There's kind of this fierce stubbornness to the characters that for me is honest of where I come from.
Yeah, there is a stubbornness too. But at the same time, I also think it's like, you know, we have this fight or flight in us. Most of us do, right?
Yeah.
It's like when your choices are death or, you know, like, right? And death can...
Fight, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like what... It's like most people, I think, would choose fight. But, and death can be... And I don't mean necessarily physical death. I mean, like, you know, like, say, in Jack's case, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen to him would be losing his brother, right? Or, right. you know, or whatever, that whatever, you know, you only care about something, you have something to lose. And, you know, death would be, Jack probably doesn't even care about death necessarily. He's staying alive because he needs to take care of his brother, and losing his brother would be the worst thing that could happen to Jack.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And that's, you know, that's a big part of this book. And it dawns on me too, thinking about it, like, he's, you know, the only one, and we won't get into details necessarily, but he's the only one with something to lose. And that really sort of like, and I mean really something to lose, right? I don't mean, you know, mm-hmm. this MacGuffin, this imaginary briefcase full of money that may or may not show up. yeah. Because, you know, but it's an interest. I really enjoy that part of the book where I'm like, all these people have this, you know, this, you know, vested interest in these two boys who, and really care nothing about, you know, the reason these boys are surviving is in a lot of ways so disconnected from the interests of all these adults. Right.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not wording mm-hmm. it right, but you know, it's, they're a story unto themselves. It's like their life is hard whether Bartom shows up or not. Right. Yeah. Basically, it's is true. What I'm saying. Yeah. So it's like there's a struggle within a struggle within this book. And I thought that was really interesting. And that's when I realized I really love this story because it works on those two levels. I think it works on a macro and a micro level.
Oh, that is such a great, I appreciate that compliment. Thank you. Because I did feel this desire to have layers to the story. I think that there's this core of the story. It's the plot and it's the machinery and it needs to run well, but it's really not the thing that I feel is most vital to talk about within that story.
Right.
Really, I didn't write the story for the plot. I wrote the story for being able to talk about the things that the plot allowed me to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple more minutes here, then we'll let you go. But, and again, this is one of the most non-spoilery discussions I think I've ever had about a book, which is amazing because it shows you how much there is to talk about this book, and it shows you how rich it is because you can have this great discussion about it without revealing the you know, the specifics and the minutia. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to say too, though, and I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, but there's like this sort of like, you know, supernatural quality to it. And, and
there is a speculative element to the framework.
There is. And, you know, it's somewhere between suggested and, you know, overt, right? so what was your, just talking about that, if you can talk about it without, you know, revealing details, what was, a lot of this has to do with something I mentioned on the intro of this podcast. That's all I'll say. Certain reading material, but mm-hmm. where was your balance there? Because you didn't, clearly it's contemporary. It is a contemporary book, but
it is.
There's an element there though. Yeah.
Well, so you've got this very naturalistic story that is framed by a speculative story.
Right.
I had no idea if that would work. I really was just, I decided if I'm going to give this my last shot, I'm going to try things that I don't know if they're going to work or not. But I'm just going to do what my heart tells me to do. And then I'll just have to wait and see.
Well, there's an interest. It works because there's a line, there's a conversation that happens near the end between Doyle and Midge about why somebody left something behind.
Yeah.
And I think that right there for me was like, because, you know, at first I was like, okay, that's kind of like it's an interesting left turn there. And then this other thing happens and then you're like, and then they have this conversation and you're like, oh, very cool. That's how I was feeling about it. I was like, good. I'm glad, you know, it's not that they necessarily know exactly what happened, but kind of, you know, they have a sense that there's something going on that's maybe bigger than themselves, right? Other forces at work, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yes. I'm going to try to not be spoilery.
Yeah,
but
it's tough. I know.
Just to focus in on the narrative framework just a little bit.
Yeah.
I've always been really fascinated with the nature of reality.
Sure.
And with this concept that we experience our lives as this very linear and finite thing, when really there's so much science and quantum physics and information out there that suggests that that may not be how it is at all, but that we might just be limited by our human experience.
Mm.
And so strewn throughout Ava's narrative are all of these little strands of thought that kind of speak to that question. And so you'll see just a bit of religion and you'll see philosophy and you'll see even some talk about chaos theory.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all just kind of a little bit from me, thoughts that I have every once in a while about, you know, this life and reality. And you see, in particular, Nietzsche's theory of eternal recurrence comes up repeatedly in Ava's narrative. And I don't think that most people even notice it, but if you look, there are all of these little mentions of the path to truth being crooked and time itself being a circle.
Well,
and all of those things are intentional.
Right. I'm not going to sit here and brag that I picked up on all of them, but I did pick up on a few of them. And I'm telling you, that's the only thing that gave me hope for when I thought there was a sequel.
right.
You know, if you know what I'm getting at. Yeah. Especially this idea of reoccurrence. Because you know why. And this also speaks to everything you just said, too, is really great. A lot of this lands at Bardem's feet, I think, too, because not sticking up for this guy. He does some bad stuff, but he can sort of wax poetic a little bit, can't he? I mean, he's kind of a thinker, isn't he? A little bit, isn't he? But he's well-rounded. He's a very three-dimensional villain for sure.
He definitely has his rules for living, doesn't he?
Yeah, you know, that's what I mean. Like, he's got a philosophy. Like, he's one of those,
He definitely believes in what he believes in, and he operates based on that.
Right.
And hopefully, you know, as the reader, you see the way that he operates, and then you see kind of what's behind it.
Right.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think that's important.
Right. Well, it's like, the thing is, too, a lot of, especially lately, I've been reading a lot of books where, you know, you actually have some sympathy for the villain in a lot of ways. And they're more of an anti-hero, I would say, probably more than just a straight up, you know, bad guy or bad person.
Yeah.
But I think you do a good job of making Bardem never sympathetic, but definitely like interesting. It's like one of those people where, like, you know, let's lock him up, but let's ask him a few questions first.
So, you know, well, that was exactly my goal, was to not make him even remotely sympathetic.
Go ahead.
But I did kind of want him to be mesmerizing. I felt like there was something really important about making him, you know, intriguing and not two-dimensional, but, you know, someone. And it's also very much based on, you know, my love of crime noir, where you have this bad guy who's, you know, he's a force to be reckoned with.
Right. He is. He most definitely is a force to be reckoned with in this book. He definitely blazes a path of fire in this book.
Right.
But, by the time this airs, the book will have come out, just come out. So it's for awesome. Sale. It'll be for sale wherever, you know, books are for sold. I don't like to support pandemic profiteers myself, so I don't like to, recommend The Scary Bald Guy, but do you have anywhere in particular? I mean, there's always bookshop.org, which is a great spot. Is there anywhere in particular?
Is
there anything you'd like to shout out? Any local shops? Any shops you'd like to shout out?
I would shout out my local indie, the King's English Bookshop here in Salt Lake City. They have a great pre-order where if you order from them, you can get a signed book plate and you can get an art print that's really cool that shows Jack and Deva.
Oh,
and
cool.
They're also just the most amazing indie. I love them so much. So
perfect.
King's English Bookshop.
King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City, Utah. Perfect.
That's right.
And also, yeah, I would recommend people ordering, like getting a physical copy of this book, because this cover is gorgeous. Who did the cover?
Elizabeth Clark at Macmillan was the director of art. And then, oh goodness, I need to, actually I have a, I'm skipping on, the jacket design was Sarah Wood.
Okay.
And she's done just a whole host of beautiful covers,
right.
Sarah Wood and Elizabeth Clark.
Okay, perfect. And there's a couple interesting plot points on the cover too. That's all I'll say about that. It does reveal a couple of things, but it's a beautiful cover. Corey, I can't thank you enough.
I love it.
Yeah, it is beautiful. Corey, I can't thank you enough. I had a really great time. Again, I really enjoyed the heck out of this book, and it's not my usual thing. Yeah, I'm mainly, like sapphic fantasies and science, not exclusively, but, science fiction and definitely, speculative fantasy and things like this. And just straight, not this is a straight thriller, but thrillers and stuff like that are my usual thing. But I'm glad I read this book because I really enjoyed it. And
You made me smile so big when I read your comments on Twitter and knowing that you loved it. I was so happy.
Yeah, so, no.
Thank you for reading.
Sure. And So I hope everyone gets a chance to pick this book up and give it a read, because like I said, I don't think people are going to be able to put it down once they start, whatever they feel about it after they're done, fine. But it's going to be great to see people's reactions to it, because I think it'll be strong. And like I said, it's getting, other than that weird torture porn guy, this is getting great reviews. other than that weirdo, I think.
We have a few outliers, but.
Of course, yeah. But, there's a lot of feedback now, and it's overwhelmingly positive. So I'm very, very happy for you, Corey. And I wish you nothing but, I almost said continued success, but technically you haven't had any success yet. not in a industry sense, I guess. You've had personal success, and it's such a huge thing just to get a book released. And I love, especially debut book. It's so much, you spent so much time focusing on this story, and obviously it's personal, but it's such a great thing just to get it out in the world. And I didn't catch I love it's I don't know if you did one or not, but it's why I love unboxing videos, because I'm such a sucker for them. I cry almost every single time.
I did one, and I started talking, opened the box, and I started crying on the unboxing video.
So. I love it. I mean, there's no better display of just like pure raw emotion. And again, because I've talked to so many authors, and I know how much time you spend on these stories and these characters, and they're yours more than anybody else's. And obviously I hope it sells a bazillion copies, but even if it sells none, it's an accomplishment in and itself. So anyways, I'm looking forward to whatever you got next, whenever that is. When can we expect something else?
I'm hoping it'll be, I don't know, in the next year. But we'll
not
see.
By this year, though. Probably 2022, I imagine, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. All right.
We'll see. I'm looking forward to it. And it's been such a pleasure.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for the invitation.
We'll get you back on for the next one, whenever that is. And maybe by then they'll have begged you to write a part two of What Beauty There Is. So who knows?
All right. That sounds wonderful. I look forward to it.
Perfect. There you have it, another episode of Everything's Canon All Wrapped Up. Huge thanks to Corey for taking the time to speak with me today. What Beauty There is definitely one of those books you'll have a hard time putting down once you start. It's got a strong first act and doesn't let up from there. Again, once you understand the personal side of the story, it makes it that much more compelling. What Beauty There is out now, so head on over to coreyanderson.us to order a copy today. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen and head on over to cinemlinks.com for the latest in movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.